Hi, I'm Meredith.
Hi, I'm Joseph, and you are listening to Are You Waiting for Permission?
It's a podcast for those who don't want to wait any longer.
How are you today, sir?
I am fine. The snow has just started in beautiful Boulder, Colorado. And that's the good news. The bad news is they just had the service for the officer who was killed on the recent attack.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we're recording this.
Rest in peace. Right.
Yes.
So we're recording this actually on Tuesday, March 30th. So there was a recent shooting in Boulder. This won't be released for several weeks. So listener, if you're wondering what Ed is referring to, that's what he's referring to.
Okay.
Meredith, how are you today?
I am good. There's a very noisy bird who's just full of life behind me, behind those gray curtains that match my sweater. And, yeah, I'm good. I'm excited to have this interview with Ed, this conversation with Ed. And so thank you. How are you, Joseph?
I'm well, thank you. So today we are with the founder and director of the Bridge of Life, a amazing, amazing humanitarian organization dedicated to making a difference every day in the lives of children. So a little bit of a backstory. A few weeks ago, I was reading a book called Leap by Sarah Davidson, and Ed was interviewed on that book. And I just want to read a small section from page 214. And listener, you will get why we were inspired to reach out to Ed when I read this. On a Sunday, Ed and two helpers broke into the Belgrade water supply and diverted a line of water to the camp of refugees. When the mayor found out, he asked, "Who gave you permission to do that?" Ed said, "God." And when I read that, I reached out to Meredith and I said, we have to find Ed Wayne Jr. We just have to. We got to get a sense of who this guy is and how he's showing up to the world with all this amazing service. So my first question to you is, when we spoke a little bit earlier, we had a technical rehearsal, and you said that one of your favorite things in the world is volunteers.
That's correct. That is correct.
Tell us more.
Well, the world couldn't function without volunteers. That's first and foremost. There is not a charity, large or small, in the world who truly could operate if it weren't for people coming forward and having a passion, a similar passion, and giving their time to volunteerism. So it's a critical role to be played by, and can be played by, everyone worldwide. And without it, things just would not function. And there are many reasons because of that. But volunteerism, everybody wins. Everybody wins. First of all, you know, there's really two sets to volunteerism in my mind. One is the economic sense. And what I mean by that is there's not a charity in the world, given the passions that all of us have, which can range from prairie dogs in Boulder, Colorado, people who are dying in a refugee camp. But there's all of those things people could claim should be the responsibility of a government, a caring political government that takes care of its people, its environment, its animals, and everything. But the fact of the matter is that just isn't the case. So there's a very important economic value to volunteers. It relieves the financial pressure on governments so that they can do other things. And it allows the citizens, and I'm not restricted to the United States, this is worldwide, to go after their particular passion and make a difference. So that's the thing. And the other part that I always want to emphasize to people is this is not beating your chest and mi culpa and, you know, I'm suffering and or I they're suffering and I want to suffer with them, but rather that there are many, many social rewards that come out of volunteerism. I mean, I do have a list, and it's not too long, but there are lots of rewards that the giver receives, not just the receiver, not just the recipient. And if you'd like me to mention those, I can certainly go into it. It's not a big deal.
Please do.
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, one thing that I always say to people is, if it's not fun, don't do it. You're not there to suffer for the world. If you're going into that, you know, join the priesthood or become a nun or something like that. First and foremost, because it's something that you enjoy doing. And the reason I encourage people to do that is because that then there's going to be longevity. Then it's not going to be a one shot. I went in on Wednesday. I hated the people. If you go in on Wednesday and you don't like the place or they don't treat you nice, you walk. You walk. You're not there to suffer. You're there to contribute your time and your energy to something, and maybe even your money, depending on your own personal circumstance. But it goes for lots of things. You know, first of all, one of the best ways to fight depression in the world is to do something for somebody else. And God knows at this point in time in the world, all of us, to some degree, are facing some level of depression. And depression comes out of when we have something that's bothering us, we have a compulsive element that revolves it and revolves it and revolves it, and we can't get off of it, and we're on it, and we're on it, and we're on it. And it's amazing, the moment you get into caring about someone else or some other cause, you're out of yourself. And so it breaks that cycle of depression. It's also great for boredom. How many people do I know who have retired and they're saying, and would say, well, how are you doing? And they say, one day's just like the last, you know? It's just another day, particularly now during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Not only, now I can't even go out. One day is just like the next. But if you're involved in something that you care about, then that boredom isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And another way is there are people who come to a new town or who are in a town and they're just not real friendly. They don't have a lot of friends. It's a wonderful way to meet people who also have a same kind of a passion or maybe the same kind of a need. So all of a sudden that lonely person is no longer lonely. He's got a whole group of like-minded people. From a commercial sense, hey, it's a great way to meet business contacts. I know people who do volunteer work and they're going there and they're specifically meeting with other people in business, in networking, they call it, but they focus it rather than on how to get a new loan in the town they're living in, but rather we're going to go volunteer and feed on Thanksgiving Day at the local homeless shelter. And while they're there, they're talking business and all of a sudden people are connecting. And again, you've got like-minded people.
That brings to mind something. I'm wondering if in addition to business contacts, Ed, is it also a good place to pick up chicks? Could you speak to how you met your wife there, Mr. Wayne?
Yes. As a matter of fact, you're reading my mind because the next thing I have is a way to meet the opposite sex. You go to the bar, and here's the scene, you know, you go to the bar and who are you? And all the guys are doing all the macho stuff and all the girls are doing all the modeling. And, you know, and please don't tell me that just happened in the 60s. That happened last night. And here you're going there and the woman looks at the guy and instead of him saying, did you see my car or look at my muscles? He's, oh, what a nice guy. Oh, isn't he? What a caring, loving, he's in touch with his feminine side. What a nice person. And yes, it's very, very true. It's a great way to meet people of the sex. Now, you asked about my wife, and that's somewhat different. I had been serving in Kosovo during the Balkan Wars. I was there during all of the bombings of 90 days, and I had the pleasure of being the first American after 1 week to enter into Belgrade, Serbia. So I was on a popularity contest. The first thing they told me is, please, Ed, don't speak English. Mm. Had bombed them for 90 days. But I was brought there by the American Refugee Committee. Long story short, after many years of work, I think it was like 4 or 5 years later, I was in a building, and there was in the same building this beautiful woman who lived above me. And I would see her as I got into my vehicle that had blue lights across the top. So, you know, again, oh, what a nice guy, he's helping kids. And we just say good morning, good afternoon, because I knew she was married. And certainly I had absolutely no interest, particularly in a city of beautiful single women. Why would I even think in my right mind to make that any more than a morning greeting or an evening greeting? And then one day we were talking, and she said something like something that made me, I said, but you're married. And she said, oh, no, I'm not. I said, what? She said, no, I'm not married. I said, you mean I've wasted a year? And she laughed like you're laughing, because one might say I'm a little bit cocky. And she said, would you like a cup, have coffee? And I said, sure. And she said, fine, why don't you come up to my flat? And that was above my flat. And then I realized that my reference was, she saw all these people, friends of mine, and knew that I, you know, liked to entertain. And I went up to her flat, and she came out with a tray. I've never been brought coffee in a tray unless I was in a restaurant, with English china and everything. And this was bizarre. And I never dated another woman.
Mm.
And that was 16 years ago, something like that. And that's how all that started. One day I said, I'm going on a driving trip. Would you like to go with me? And she said, well, sure. Where are you going? I said, well, I'm shipping an emergency vehicle from Houston, Texas to Germany. I'm going to drive it from Germany down to Belgrade. And then I'm going to drive it to Kathmandu, Nepal. And she said, okay. And her theory is, if she were here, she'd tell you, but she escaped, coward. She would tell you that she figured if we could survive, just the two of us, an emergency vehicle driving from Europe to Kathmandu, Nepal, Asia, we could survive a long-term relationship. And we did. And that's how we are together 24/7. The only time we're apart is right now, when she'll go get her nails done or her hair done. And otherwise, we're together. She's the only woman in the world who goes into a refugee camp, but first, before she opens the door, looks in the mirror and she puts her lipstick. And I, what are you doing? She says, I'm doing it for me. I said, okay, great. So
I want to give a shout out to your wife, Tanya, because she has a degree in civil engineering, and she oversees all the project management for all of your multiple projects.
That is correct.
For, I guess, the last 16 years, no?
That is correct. She's amazing. She's amazing, and she is a tough cookie, and she people don't intimidate her. And she just knows how to just bat those eyes in front of a government official, and they just, you know, they just melt. I'm sorry she's not here, because she's beautiful, and she's very cool and knows how to manage people, and mostly manage men, obviously. She certainly
sounds like a woman after my own heart.
And I'm a handful. But
one thing, Ed, that I also read in the book by Sarah Davidson, Leap, was that the reason that you're so attracted to working in that part of the world is that you don't wait for permission. You're not looking at building codes and all those kinds of things. You're just going in and you're building. You're looking at the need and you're striking force, as they say.
Right. We really couldn't do what we have chosen to do we could not afford to do, for example, in America because of the cost. We couldn't afford to do because of the time frame of permits and everything else. And we always let it be the obligation of whoever we're helping. They come up, they get a, if their permit's required, they take care of that. And then if there aren't permits required, then when we land, we dig in and we stay until it's done.
Ed, can you tell us, can you give our listeners a little bit of the seed of your journey, how you ended up in this humanitarian role? What was the seed to all of this for you?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
I had another life for over 30 years. I was the founder and CEO of a multinational corporation. And I was and am a single dad. And I always, as my parents instilled in me giving, I tried to do that with my children, except I did it too well. Because one day, both of my children came to me and said, you know, we really don't want to go into your business. We really don't want to go into business. Mm. We want to do something to help mankind, which they do. And then I'm thinking like, well, what am I doing? You know, all I'm doing is creating an estate nightmare. And I loved what I did. You know, I love what I did. And so in a very short period, within 60 days, the good news was I sold my company, and the bad news was I sold my company. And that was, had been for over 30 years, my entire identification. And I didn't know what to do. And then I had a bunch of friends who also owned company. Oh, and I did some consulting for them. And then one of them one day is making all kinds of money over something that I designed for him. And I said, what am I doing? If I was in it to make money, I'd just keep my own business and do that. Now, this isn't what I want to do. So I regrouped and I went back. I still had a residence in Houston as well as Boulder. I went back to Houston just to regroup. And I was with a friend watching TV. I remember it like yesterday, drinking a nice glass of wine, and CNN came on and it was about Kosovo and the refugees of both sides going. It was winter. There was nobody there. There was no camps. It was snowing. They had no aid. They had nothing. And I mean, really, it's really hokey, but I said, I'm going. And my friend said to me, a longtime buddy, friend of mine, girl buddy, she was a buddy. And she said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going there. He said, well, what are you going to do there? I said, they said they don't even have people to hand out blankets. And the next morning, I called a friend of mine in Washington, and I told him, who knows me well, and I said, I want to know, go, what? How do we do this? He said, you really want to do this? I said, I really want to do it. And he called, he said, stay by your phone. And I got a call from an organization who basically needed a bag man. There was no banks, there was nothing. And I said, so that's what you're looking for. You need somebody to carry over cash. And you need, he said, yes, and we understand. We've already got a heads up on you that you know about logistics, international logistics. We need places for our people to stay. We need a place to rent. There's nobody there. There's no aid. None of the aid organizations are even there. They found landmines around CARE International's building. Nobody wants to go in. I said, okay. He said, so when can you go? And cocky as I am and dumb at the moment, I said, what time is it? And he laughed. And 2 days later, I was in Thessaloniki, Greece, telling him I was going to Macedonia. And that was a big mistake because I was in Greece saying I was going to Macedonia. And the woman at the restaurant stands up to this entire restaurant of guys with no necks where they went from their ears to their shoulder. And she said, you're listening to the American? He's going to Macedonia. Hey, mister, you're in Macedonia. Well, so that was my introduction to that.
I'm kind of privileged that I can put one ear towards our listener and what our listeners likely thinking or hearing, but thinking right now is they have the American disease. They have no time and they have no money. So they don't have the privilege of what you had to be able to travel internationally and fund these projects. What would you say to those that are listening that say they don't have any time and they don't have any money to do what Ed Wayne does?
Well, I have good news. You do have the time and you do have the money. And what I mean by that is it doesn't take some vast amount of money and it doesn't take a huge amount of time. If this is what is inside of you, that somehow, some way, for some cause, you want to make a difference. You can do that. And it's just a matter of finding something that meets your capabilities in terms of time. Nobody says you have to do it for a month or a year or even a week. It might be one day a month. It might be an hour, one day a week. It might be walking some lady, I know it sounds like it's a Boy Scout commercial, across an intersection. But all of these things, to one degree or another, will give you satisfaction. And it cannot, sometimes, it doesn't even take an action in terms of a physical going to. It can be a kind word. It can be a smile. It reminds me of the two definitions that I have always known about giving. And to me, the selfish nation, collective nation of people says, I hope my neighbor's cow dies. Meaning, I don't have a cow, he's got a cow. I hope his cow dies and he's as miserable as I am. And believe me, there's far too many people who approach charity in that manner, okay? But then there's the sharing nation. And the sharing nation is, if you'll pardon me, a Serbian saying that I learned in the first hospital I went to in Serbia. And it's called a smile. It says one smile doesn't cost anything, but it makes the one who receives it rich and does not make the giver poor. No one is so rich that they do not need it. No one is so low class that they do not deserve it. It only lasts a moment, but the memory of it can last forever. If you ever meet someone that's forgotten how to smile, give that person one smile from your heart, because no one wants it more than the person who can't give it to another. So we can all do things.
I love that.
It's not off after dinner conversation. It's when you go to bed and you can say, man, I helped somebody today. That's a good feeling.
That's beautiful. Did it take any convincing of on your part for Tanya to come on board with these projects?
No, that's who Tanya is. Tanya, even as a child growing up in a small village in Serbia, southern Serbia, was surrounded. That area is with a Roma, gypsy population. We call them Roma in that part because it's towards Albania and Kosovo. And she at an early age was helping out in the classroom to the slower students because she's very smart, and tutoring them. It's something that both of her parents were teachers. Matter of fact, her father was, under the time of Tito, was imprisoned because he was against communism, and then was asked because he was so smart to teach again. So they gave her the values that she carried with her. And they, you know, we're a strange couple. You know, the chances of us, you know, a guy, she's much my junior. She has never been able to have children, so she was free to move, and the giving is a natural thing with Tanya. No problem at all.
How can our listeners give and support your work?
We don't ask for donations. We are crazy. And we use my money, but you make a good point. But years ago, both my children called me to again, my children together confronted me and they know the pitch. And they said, I don't know if I can say the words they said. Well, yeah, they said, you're a selfish son of a bitch. And I said, what do you mean by that? You get all of this gratification, you get all of this pleasure. And whenever any of us or your friends want to donate, no, no, you're doing it. You're going to do it all yourself and you don't need anybody to donate. And so I said, you're right. And what I developed on every project, we have a wish list and it's for contents of, if let's suppose we're building a clinic and it's got to have a bed in it. And it's got to have an examination table. It's got to have a medicine cabinet or something. We always put out a wish list and we send it out now to our family and friends. In the beginning, I thought, I don't feel good about this. And then we're hearing people say, we got together last night at dinner and we decided we're going to buy a bed. And we have, and we always give them the price. We tell them if they don't tell us where the money goes, we won't do it. And they say, we want to buy one bed for $50. And so then we do that. And then at each project, we put up a sign, the wish list. But you know, you're specifically asking me what could your listeners do to support us?
Yes.
And as I think about it, I can really tell you, I tell you what you can do to support me. Go find your own passion and go do it. And you have supported me. It would make me happier. You want to donate to me? Donate to the world. Wow. Find that thing that you can afford to do through money or through time that you like, that's your passion, and go do it. That's how you can support me.
Ed, thank you so much for that. That's, yes, I love that invitation. And I want to reflect back a little bit when you were talking about, when I asked you the question about the seed that led you to where you are now. I had this image of stepping stones for people, that it's not, it doesn't happen overnight, that it's one stepping stone at a time, which is you opened the door by saying, this is what I need to do. And you were called to do it. You were passionate about that call. And you just placed one stone after the next until you achieved that goal and started to help others in the way that you felt called to do that. And so I want to reemphasize that it is one small step at a time sometimes to get to those achievements that we want to make and to be patient with that. And as long as you're really clear about your purpose and that passion you speak about, Ed, that these can be achievable goals for yourself. You can go and you can help others. You can volunteer. You can smile at that person that looks like they need one. So I want to say thank you for that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's right. It does. You don't have to save the world. You know, you might save a squirrel. I don't know what you're asking.
I have saved a squirrel.
Oh, good.
I have.
Was it like mouth to mouth and you had a pump on his chest? Or what?
No, that would have been super cute. No, no.
One thing I would say on a serious note, and that is, we run across lots of people with passions and with all good intentions. They can do more damage than good. So whatever it is that you're going to do, please think it through, because you don't want to give people false hope. You don't want to sell dreams. We know too many horror stories of people who've gone in to do something. They get a particular population dependent on them. And then they disappear because they decide they want to go play tennis or golf and the whole thing falls apart except for the people. And so what I do say, it's wonderful, find your passion, but make sure, take a moment and say, how can this continue? Am I setting us up for failure? Am I sure that everything I do is going to have a good and positive response? And don't make false promises. Don't sell dreams, because they'll remember your dreams and they're waiting for you. Don't be nonprofit that comes in and takes the pictures of the little bloated tummy babies, goes back home and does a great fundraiser. And the people with the little babies thought you were going to come back to help them. Yeah.
So
please consider that.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. Important. Thank you.
ladies and gentlemen of our listening audience, thebridgeoflife.net is where you can read about the work of Ed and his lovely wife, Tanya. And Ed, we'd like to finish with one word. If you could use one word to describe your experience with us in this podcast today, what would that be?
Rewarding.
Meredith?
Grateful.
I'm going with help. Go out there and help.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, and good luck in finding your passion.
We want to thank Amy Shelley and Gary Grundy of High Fiction for letting us use their music in this podcast. Please join us next week when we have a great discussion with Trent Norman and Rebecca Brown Adelman with Affinity Arts. Take care, have a great week, and remember, please like, comment, and subscribe.